This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. H.T. McMullen has it rough. His wife left him. His boss fired him. He lives in a one-room shack in the woods, and he has fleas. But when he discovers a plot to pollute the small North Carolina town of Yatesville, he risks everything he has left to do what's right. McMullen is the main character in the debut novel by Pittsburgh writer Ashley Memory. The book is called Naked and Hungry, and Ashley Memory joins me in the studio now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You grew up in Pittsburgh, and that's a kind of a small town. Did that have anything to do with the creation of Yatesville?
Well, I actually grew up in Ashboro, which is a small town west of that. I've lived in Pittsburgh for about 3 years now. Absolutely. Yatesville, the town of Yatesville, is really a melting pot of all the small towns that I've grown up and adored, such as Ashboro. Certainly other people as far away as Elizabethtown tell me, hey, Yatesville could be Elizabethtown. So I've enjoyed that.
Was that something you wanted to do, was sort of characterize that kind of life?
Well, writers write about the world they know, and that's really the world that I know. There's, you know, I believe that the North Carolina small towns are really our state's greatest treasure. So absolutely, there's a lot in the small towns that lend themselves well to a novel.
Do you have to know what the small town is compared to something else? I mean, do you have to sort of be away from it or see it as an entity? Because if you grow up in it, that's not a small town. That's where people live, right?
Right. Well, in between, you know, there are obviously a lot of other things happening in my life. But I did live in Raleigh for about 14 years, and that was an experience I enjoyed immensely. We recently, my husband and I, returned to Pittsburgh, which, yes, allowed me to think about the small towns in a different way.
Now, this main character, H.T. McMullen, describe him for us.
Well, it's so funny. This, to me, really, there's a lot of things happening in the novel, but Naked and Hungry is really a novel of character. It is inspired by the reverent figure of none other than my father, Joseph Gale Thomas. He has been a stockbroker for years, so as you can imagine, his life, personal and his career, has seen a variety of ups and downs. But what's admirable about him is that he's at a place in his life where he can sit back and laugh. H.T., too, is at a level where he's achieved a new state of self-awareness. He worked in the financial industry for years as a loan officer. As you mentioned, he lost his job, he lost his marriage. Things have come full circle for him, and this is one of the reasons he decides to retreat to a one-room shack, for lack of a better word, in the woods.
And as a loan officer, this is in these times, so he's making those loans that eventually went bad and had to call people on it. People were losing their homes, and it's because of him.
Right, and he will tell you in the book, he says he's a loser, and he feels that way. When times were high and they had... His boss was certainly a corrupt character. One of the villains is the bank president. He was famous for his five-minute mortgage approval program, you know, which made him a temporary hero. But H.T. had to award the mortgages and then, in the end, had to deliver the foreclosure notices to the people that he had known all his life.
Yeah, because he became more famous for his one-minute foreclosure hearings. So that's all part of it. And H.T. could be the bad guy, modeled on your dad, pretty rough. But it turns out that in this shack, he has time to reflect on his life.
Right. And as a result of moving, you know, to the woods, he's given up on the rat race. He's not in this business to make money. That's what makes him a hard character to live with. The villains think, okay, he can't be bought. What kind of man is he?
That's pretty tough. Now, there's some autobiographical elements, as you've already suggested, particularly the parts about selling Starbucks short.
Yes, yes.
and just for those of you who don't do a lot of investing, that means in most cases we invest hoping that the value of the company will go up. They actually have these instruments on Wall Street so that if it goes down, kind of insurance policy, you win. That's selling short or buying
short, right?
That's right.
And H.T. decided he was strapped for cash. He had a mortgage he couldn't afford himself, a lot of loans going on. And in a weak moment, he said, hey, you know, he talked a buddy into doing it, which is never a good idea, especially for a long-term friendship. You know, what is this, these lattes? I don't understand. You know, what kind of person would pay $4 for lattes and frappuccinos? Well, he soon learned, because the process of short sale is that the seller benefits from the difference between the price of the repurchase and the former price. And in his case, he bet on the wrong side of the house and lost $60,000.
Which is something you have personal experience with.
Well, I've certainly thought about it a lot. the good news is I've not quite had the nerve to do that. But there's many instances in this book. It's funny. There are some things that are from personal experience. I mean, you know, who hasn't dreamed of, you know, attending their own funeral and then faking a case of amnesia when people find out that you're still alive. I mean, that was a lot of fun. I haven't done that, but I've certainly thought about it.
Yeah. And so, and H.T., tell us about this now. How much do you want to reveal about, because it's a fascinating plot about this. He's thinking deeply in the wilderness and there's trouble.
Right. He learns of the trouble when he pulls out a bass from his local fishing hole and it's purple. The water is putrid, and he knows there's something going on, and it bothers him because he thought that he retreated to this pristine, you know, retreat in the woods where he could just be himself. So what happens is he reports this to an environmental action agency, and in doing so, he comes face to face with the one person who can save him, a sexy environmentalist named Jessica Bean, and being a novel, of course, he falls for her. And she comes in. She's got a dangerous secret of her own, which gets them both into even deeper trouble. In fact, one of the reasons he is known for dead is that people believe that the plot to kill him by the real bad guys has succeeded. So he and Jessica find themselves on the run.
By the way, I don't know if you know this, but Purple Bass was actually Jimi Hendrix's first choice for the title of his famous song, and then he changed it.
I did not know that, but maybe it was imprinted in my subconscious mind.
I made that up. It's a lie.
Oh.
Purple Bass in my mind. Would you please read for us? Read a little bit of something for us, Ashley. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Where in the world had all the lightning bugs gone? This question had been needling H.T. McMullen for weeks now. Sitting out on his front porch overlooking the deep woods, he should have been able to enjoy the serenity of the June evening. But it was too serene, and this was what troubled him. The numerous deer, which used to strip his blackberry bushes to the thorns, had all but disappeared, and the nightly serenade of field crickets, once deafening, had come to a halt. He leaned back into his fold-out camp chair, stretched, and took another swig of beer. His dog Shorty suddenly sat up from his usual heap on the floor beside him and growled, "Hey, boy, settle down." From out of nowhere came a loud pop, followed by a sharp pain in H.T.'s left calf. The popping continued, and this time Shorty rolled off the porch and fell to the ground. That's when H.T. realized that they'd both been shot. What the hell? The beer can slid from his hand as he dropped to his knees and crawled inside his cabin. Groping in the darkness, he reached for his toolbox and pulled out his gas-powered nail gun. Now in his belly, he inched to the front door and peered outside. Although he couldn't see anything, he aimed the nail gun straight ahead and fired two shots through the screen into the darkness. All fell eerily silent for a moment until he heard a rustle of leaves, followed by the whir of a car speeding away in the distance. The dog, moaning softly, still lay on the ground.
Ashley Memory reading from her debut novel, Naked and Hungry. We got a dog with a slug in his chest, a purple bass, and an environmental disaster that he's facing as well. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, as part of this plot, the plot that unveils when he realizes his favorite pond is being polluted, it turns out that his former boss, the man that arguably he quit or he was fired from that job, we've all been in that situation, but he learns that his former boss was involved in a plot to traffic hazardous waste to the rural outpost where he lives now, and that's part of a larger organized crime ring that includes racketeering. It includes this same bad guy, the wealthy industrialist from Raleigh, is actually arranging for other investors to buy those homes that have been foreclosed upon it, and that's part of a money laundering scheme.
So all of this intrigue and high finance, the financial sector and its involvement in our troubles these days, as well as environmental issues, could all be drawn from the headlines. Was that something you had intended to do, or when did that all of that come to you as part of the grist for this particular novel?
Well, it's interesting, and that's a great question. You know, as I mentioned before, this really, for me, began as a novel of character, because for me, and I'll quote the words of Joyce Carey, a great early 20th century British novelist, fiction is not really a place for arguments. It's a place for emotional truths. So I started with the story of a man who decided to retreat to the woods. Well, that is great, but it wouldn't be a novel if there weren't a larger context to draw upon. So I started doing a little research. Okay, I used to work for a bank. We have the mortgage crisis. That's something, but we need really bad guys to make this happen. And I learned through some research that organized crime is not owned by the mafia. Organized crime is a bunch of bad guys getting together, in this case, and trying to make some money. So I did a little research and learned that there had been a big scandal that I think is still going on in Michigan, when a contractor that was contracted to demolish and build, demolish an old furniture factory had dumped 26,000 tons of contaminated soil on the Grand River watershed there. And fingers are still being pointed, I think, in that current scandal, but the consequences of this kind of thing have yet to be understood. And I saw, you know, this might could happen in a smaller scale. We hope not. We hope it wouldn't, but bad guys are everywhere.
Bad guys are everywhere, and it works a whole lot more smoothly when, if you're in organized crime, you've got the law on your side, which sometimes happens. There's a character in here, H.T.'s mother, Myrtle, and she is kind of an it's kind of an archetype of the Southern woman. When did she come to you, and how important is she to this novel?
Well, it's funny. The primary character is male, right? And obviously, I'm female, so I had to draw upon the men in my life to, you know, have a basis for that. But the females in this book, to me, are just as interesting. They all have a strong agenda, certainly starting with Myrtle, his mother. Her main agenda is to get to heaven any way she can do it, even at the risk of her son. When you write a book set in the South, there's always the risk that you're going to draw too heavily on stereotypes. So I thought about Myrtle. There's a little of my grandmother in there for sure. You know, a little bit of the Bible-toting, you know, God-fearing mother, meddlesome mother to some degree. But I thought, well, what would make her not so stereotypical is to give her a goat. My grandmother grew up on a farm. She would never bring a goat in the house. But the idea of Myrtle having an African pygmy goat and take it around a small town, you could probably sneak a goat into some of these places, you know. So that's some of the things behind the thought process that went into Myrtle.
But it's the great thing about Southern writing. You do have to evoke things that we're familiar with, things we understand about the South, in order to make it, to place it here. And yet what makes it good writing and interesting writing is just that, something that then takes the type and plays against it. And then all of a sudden we get to see things in a new way.
Right. And the emotional truth is that you have characters that you can identify, you know, whether you come from the South or the North. I mean, sometimes we've all been naked and hungry, you know, going back to the time we were born. There's a great argument that says, you know, metaphorically, that we ought to end this life the way we begin it. That way we know we're not going to consume far more than we need. But for me, the beauty of using a small town as the backdrop was that you have a close-knit cast of characters already. They care about themselves. You know, when I went to my 20th high school reunion, the divorce of my parents was the topic. Ashley, we heard what happened. You know, the whole town is talking about it. And I thought, well, you know what? Nobody's going to love me more than the people that I grew up with, you know, and they're thinking about me and my family. So for me, that was a wonderful backdrop for this novel.
When did you start writing?
I started writing, my parents will tell you, there were shreds of short stories and all sorts of things, poorly written short stories all over the house. But certainly, you know, in my early teens, I started writing. When I wanted to make this as a profession, I majored in English at Carolina. I was lucky enough to land some jobs where I could have writing, you know, as a profession. It wasn't obviously writing novels and short stories. It began doing editing, some things like that. Again, I've been really lucky. I've landed jobs where I could eventually write speeches, briefing memos, press releases. And if you could write a press release and summarize an idea on a page, you know, you could do short stories and novels.
And had you always aspired to this? Were you thinking about doing it the whole time?
Well, short stories is where I started because I love short stories so much. Having the ability to sustain something over the longer term, this has been an act of will for me to do a longer work.
When did you decide? Was that a conscious decision for you? Okay, I'm going to break. I'm going to do a novel. Or had you, put it this way, had you been resisting writing a novel for a long time?
You know, that's a great way of looking at it. I think I had. I really had. But, you know, I'd sent short stories off before, and I've had a number of them published. An agent called me in New York once and said, "Do you have a novel here?" I said, "Well, you know, I hadn't thought about it, really." He said, "Well, novels are what sell. You know, now it's nice to see that short stories sell well, too." But again, going back to the inspiration for H.T., my dad and I were walking around a bookstore one day. He said, "You can do this. Look at this book. You could write something so much better than this book." And it was nice to have somebody to believe in me like that. But it took a little bit of, inside will and then the support of my dad.
What does he think of the book?
Well, he loves it. He sees if this becomes a movie, you know, George Clooney playing H.T.
Because it's him.
Of course.
And that's what he wants. You know, you talked earlier about the fact that, and the quote that you used that said, look, fiction writing is not about sending a message, something along those lines. It's about a fundamental truth. And yet you've done press releases and all of that, which is definitely message oriented. You've got a point to make. You need to get it done. Did you have to fight that? Did you have to fight your professional training in order to get at the emotional
emotional truth.
A little bit, but for me, even writing the press release back then, it's the emotional truth. What does this mean? I'll use an example, writing a press release about a construction project. I mean, we had to think about what this means for the motorist when I worked at the Department of Transportation. You have to think about that. And for me, it was the larger, it made it more interesting for me to think about that. And it was really helpful for me with this novel because, like I mentioned, you can't just write a book about a guy moving to the woods. You know, he's you know, achieved his dream. That's not interesting beyond the first page.
Plus, Thoreau has already done it, so.
Right, right. Exactly.
Ashley, thanks so much for being with us. What a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Talking today with Ashley Memory. She is the author of the novel Naked and Hungry. And to learn more about her and to get a listing of her events, go to ashley-memory.com. State of Things for today. Thank you for listening. You know, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org, and I've got an invitation for you. You can find a link to our events, of course. But on Friday, November 4th, I'm going to be at the Haw River Ballroom in Saxapahoy. It's a great ballroom, a lot of fun. I'm going to be there with playwright Howard Kraft and some of the cast of the Jade City Pharaoh, a new radio drama series about a black superhero. It's going to premiere soon on the State of Things. We're going to have a 10-part series on Jade City Pharaoh. It's going to be a kind of a one-of-a-kind series, Jade City, written by Howard Kraft. We're going to be at the Haw River Ballroom on November 4th. Going to have Sherlett Ammons, the Dynamite Brothers, Spoken Word by the Sacrificial Poets. The event's going to raise some money to support the production of Jade City Pharaoh. For more information, go to HawRiverBallroom.com or visit our Facebook page. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.